Welcome to Context and Clarity. I am Chuck.
I am Karen.
I used to be a Democrat.
I used to be a Republican.
I am still a liberal.
And I'm still a conservative. But after our parties left us, we're not really sure what we are. But we do know this. As Abraham Lincoln reminds us, we are not enemies. We are friends.
We are friends.
We are.
Still friends. And do your kids listen to the podcast, Karen?
Sometimes.
Well, today is a special day for one of them. Happy birthday, big guy.
Ah, yeah. Today is Sean's birthday. He's turning 17. So
that means you are getting old.
Yeah. Thanks for that. I appreciate that. It's great.
Well, what are we going to be talking about this week, Karen?
Well, today we are going to be talking about North Korea. So the president is set to meet again with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. And there's always a lot of controversy surrounding these meetings. The president himself fuels much of the confusion with quotes like, "I was really being tough and so was he." And we would go back and forth. "And then we fell in love. No, really, he wrote me beautiful letters." Or, "I like him and he likes me. We have a great relationship." This can all be pretty baffling. Do we want North Korea to denuclearize? Yes. Should we trust them to? No. Why? History shows us a roadmap of failed attempts at diplomacy, but there's a much deeper problem, the one of legitimizing this nation. And we'll explain why. But before we get into that, let's do a short primer on North Korea.
When the Second World War ended in 1945, Japan lost control of Korea to the Allied forces, and Korea was divided at the 38th parallel, with the Soviet Union administering the northern half and the U.S. administering the southern half. In 1948, Kim Il-sung, communist leader of the Korean People's Army, convinced the Soviet that the United Nations shouldn't be allowed north of that dividing line, so elections never happened in Korea. By the end of the year, two distinct nations had been developed, very much like Germany after the Second World War. The Republic of Korea in the South, led by democratically elected President Syngman Rhee, and the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, henceforth known as DPRK in the North, with USSR-backed Kim Il-sung as premier. Now, most U.S. forces left South Korea by the middle of 49, leaving behind a new, somewhat weak government and a rather inexperienced army. In contrast, North Korea had the financial and military strength of the USSR behind it, and China helped them build up a strong army.
The early organizational structure of North Korea was similar to Stalinist Russia, with a heavy focus on military buildup and heavy industry, mostly mining. Kim stuck with his Stalinist philosophy even as his communist neighbors kind of evolved. In the 1970s, North Korean mining production had reached its peak. Sudden rises in the price of foreign oil, combined with falling prices for North Korea's native minerals, hit the economy really hard. The surrounding nations adapted their economies to emerging technology, like computers, which North Korea was just not able to keep up with, thus causing Kim to make the tough decision to take on foreign debt to keep the economy afloat, which contradicted his carefully crafted and integrated ideology of juche, or self-reliance. In the 70s and 80s, relations between North Korea and the rest of the world were in constant flux. Discussions on reunifying or co-hosting the 88 Seoul Olympics and economic cooperation stopped and started constantly. North Korea announcing its growing nuclear program didn't really make it any global friends either.
Yeah, that tends to make people standoffish at parties,
right,
when you come in with a nuclear missile.
Yeah, usually.
Well, both North Korea and South Korea officially joined the United Nations in September of 1991. The 90s carried a slew of broken promises by North Korea to shut down or halt its nuclear program and allow international inspectors in. Then in 1994, Kim Il-sung died of a sudden heart attack. Kim's son, Kim Jong-il, succeeded his father and adopted an ideology known as Sungun, Army First, which turned the country from a traditional communist government to a military dictatorship. And the nuclear program marched on with fervor.
You like that?
Nice prose there, Karen.
Yeah, military dictatorship, marching. You get the imagery I was going for there? Yeah.
I got it. That was a nice picture you painted there.
Thanks.
Picasso. So, okay, Hemingway, let me continue. Those nuclear ambitions took a back burner in the late 1990s when the country suffered through horrific flooding, followed by drought because of famine and a failing economy. It's like these guys were having biblical problems there. The only thing they didn't have was frogs and leeches.
Yeah. Well, the leeches aren't really... Okay, just keep going.
Leeches aren't in the Bible?
No.
It's crickets or something. Isn't it? What is it?
Locusts.
Okay. I knew it was something. I knew it was something.
Started with an L. You were close enough.
Yeah. Well, because of famine, a failing economy, and a disintegrating infrastructure, North Korea began to rely on foreign aid to keep its citizens fed. In 2005, North Korea bragged about its first underground nuclear test. I'm laughing because I said that about the leeches. And my son Tanner listens to this and he said, I like when Karen calls you ignorant. I just realized how ignorant I sounded. So anyway.
Well, okay. Think about what you just said there, though. North Korea bragged about its first underground nuclear test. If it's an underground nuclear test, doesn't bragging about it kind of automatically make it not underground?
Well, I think it was physically underground.
Oh, was it physically underground?
Okay, you're ignorant.
I'm the ignorant one.
Okay, I don't feel nearly as ignorant now.
I just did that to help you. I just did that to make you feel better.
Okay, thank you. I do now. Yeah, I feel much better now. I'm like E equals MC squared now. Now this, combined with the country's continued nuclear efforts, reported human rights violations. Don't laugh at human rights violations.
I wasn't laughing at that.
Have earned its global dangerous misfit characterization. Now, Kim Jong-il died on December 17, 2011, and his son, Kim Jong-un, took power. Now, that is the general history of the country and why we have to continuously make diplomatic efforts to restrain their nuclear program. So we're going to give you a timeline real quickly of U.S. relations with North Korea. But basically, you had three leaders since the Second World War.
The Kim family. Yeah. There you go. Well, from 1960 to 1990 is kind of what we're going to cover first. In 1968, the DPRK captured the USS Pueblo, which was an American intelligence ship, spy ship, and it tortured its 83 crew members for 11 months. Eventually, the U.S. signed an acknowledgement and an apology statement that was drafted by North Korea, after which U.S. General Woodward repudiated, saying the whole thing wasn't true and he only signed it to release the crew. And the crew was released, all but one member who died in captivity. The North Koreans still hold the USS Pueblo as a museum of military victory. Some congressional representatives and naval veterans groups are actually calling for President Trump to demand the USS Pueblo be returned as part of the talks that are scheduled for next week. And Chuck, do you know who was president during the capture of the USS Pueblo?
Johnson, your favorite president.
Yes. I mean, he's not my favorite, but he is very interesting to me. So in 1969, an American reconnaissance plane was shot down by North Korea. 31 Americans were killed. Due to Cold War escalation and the ongoing Vietnam War, President Nixon chose not to retaliate, but instead amped up intelligence gathering missions.
In 1976, the joint security area between North and South Korea, a poplar tree that North Korea claims was planted by Kim Il was routinely trimmed for observation purposes. Reports indicate this was an agreed upon practice, but in August of that year, North Korean soldiers armed with axes and metal pikes attacked the group trimming the tree. killing 2 American soldiers, wounding 4 more, and wounding 5 South Korean soldiers. You know, how are you attacking soldiers with pikes?
Right.
Are we like in 1200?
I mean, we're talking about North Korea, so.
I know, but I mean, our soldiers.
Right.
It's like,
yeah.
Don't they have machine gun turrets and stuff up there?
That's pretty crazy. Well, I mean, it was an agreed upon thing. They were doing something that everybody.
They tricked them.
Right. Yeah.
Now, President Ford and South Korea worked out a plan of retaliation known as Operation Paul Bunyan, where in a show of force, they cut down the tree with a contingent of soldiers and weaponry alongside them. Now, that doesn't really seem like retaliation when you've killed a bunch of soldiers and wounded a bunch to just chop down a tree.
It was,
but I guess that was the best we could do.
Well, I mean, it was a really, really big. There were like helicopters. I mean, there was a whole bunch of reinforcements there to show force. So I don't really think it was retaliation as much as it was political theater.
Yeah, right. But the tree regretted. I mean, the tree was sad.
I felt bad for the tree. It wasn't the tree's fault.
You really felt bad for the tree?
I did, actually. As I was writing this, I was like, poor tree. Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, well, during the Cold War era, North Korea manifested sympathy for the Marxist agenda and pro-Cuban stance of Grenada and gave them $12 million worth of weapons and ammunition for free. Now, despite North Korea's support, the U.S. invaded Grenada in 1983 with 4 Navy SEALs and 6 guns.
No.
And those $12 million worth of weapons didn't really do them much good. Now, this intensified North Korea's fear of imperialism. Now, with the help of the Soviet Union, North Korea began to work on a nuclear complex, and in the early 1980s, built its first power plant. And one of the things we should mention throughout this is, you know, they all seem crazy a little bit, but they are very fearful of American imperialism.
Well, in the 1990s, Jimmy Carter became the first former U.S. president to visit North Korea, where he laid the groundwork for further diplomatic talks. Then the Clinton administration and North Korea signed something called the Agreed Framework. That was actually the name of the agreement to freeze North Korea's nuclear program. Most experts agree that this was actually the closest Washington came to a successful deal with North Korea. Pyongyang agreed to freeze construction of nuclear reactors and production of plutonium in exchange for aid, fuels, and other economic benefits. Then the DPRK, in a test flight, sent a missile flying over Japan. This seems to be what they always do. Like,
it's like, you know, they're one of your kids.
I know.
You keep grounding and then saying, you know what? I'm going to let you have your phone back. Just don't be such a jerk.
And then they do the thing. Yeah.
No, then they just snatch the phone out of your hand and say, don't tell me what to do.
Right. Well, after they did that, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright met with Kim Jong-il to try and expand the agreed framework. Again, that's what it was called. And prepare a potential visit by President Bill Clinton. Unfortunately, the talks failed.
Well, when you get to the 2000s, now in 2002 in the State of the Union address, President Bush labeled North Korea as part of an axis of evil, along with Iran, Iraq, and my co-host. Now, the United States stopped oil shipments to DPRK in a dispute over the country's secretive nuclear weapons program, specifically uranium enrichment. And then the 6-party talks began. And guess how many countries were involved in that, Karen?
I'm going to go with 6, Chuck.
Okay, good answer. The 6-party talks were a series of multilateral negotiations held intermittently since 2003 and attended by China, Japan, North Korea, Russia, South Korea, and the United States for the purpose of dismantling North Korea's nuclear program. The talks were hosted in Beijing and chaired by China. In 2003, DPRK withdrew from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. You didn't think I was going to get that word right, did you, Karen?
I didn't think so. You impressed me, Chuck.
Six-party talks in 2007 led to a plan for North Korea to shut down its nuclear enrichment program and allow for international inspections. In September of 2007, U.S. State Department announced that North Korea would catalog and dismantle its entire nuclear program by the end of the year. It's like, again, your kid saying, I promise I'm going to go make my bed, but they never do.
Right.
In October, President Bush formally removed North Korea from the U.S. terror watch list because nobody can get out of North Korea to be a terrorist. So, I mean, how are you going to really be a good terrorist coming out of North Korea? In 2009, the six-party talks collapsed following an impasse over granting international inspectors permission to visit sites in North Korea.
In 2011, Kim Jong-il died amid President Barack Obama's efforts to revive peace talks. His son Kim Jong-un took power, and which is kind of unfortunate because, you know, he had to establish himself as a strong man. And when you're trying to establish peace talks, that's not very good timing. President Obama tried to push the new regime to the negotiating table by ratcheting up sanctions. But Kim Jong-un thwarted a final deal that would have halted North Korea's nuclear weapons program and allowed for international inspectors in exchange for U.S. aid. Meanwhile, North Korea continued to make strides in its nuclear weapons program. Then, in 2016, President Donald Trump unleashed a flurry of heavy-handed rhetoric against North Korea, threatening to rain down fire and fury if it continued to escalate tensions with the United States. North Korea test-fired a slew of ballistic missiles and conducted its sixth and most powerful nuclear test. Then, South Korean President Moon Jae-in helped bring about potential talks between Trump and Kim following overtures from Washington and North Korea at his country's Winter Olympics. The Trump administration credits its economic and diplomatic pressure campaign for bringing North Korea to the table. Of course it does. In June, President Trump met with Kim Jong-un in Singapore, and things appeared to go pretty well, although official details were few and far between. So, now we see the back and forth that's dictated our relationship with the DPRK. But now let's take a closer look at the country as it is now and look at exactly who we are dealing with.
North Korea is actually a very small country. It's a little bit larger than Virginia, a little bit smaller than Mississippi. The population as of 2018 was roughly 25 million. We do not have updated estimates, but in 2013, over 18 million of those did not have access to electricity. Only 30% of the population, including the urban areas, have electricity. Now, 2016 estimates show approximately 2 million had access to landline, fixed telephone lines. And 3.5 million had registered cell phones. This comes out to about 14% of the people. And the service with those with access, it's very limited by government restrictions. They can't have Snapchat on their phones. They can't have Instagram on their phones. I mean, they crack down pretty hard on them. You can't even play Words with Friends
right
on your phones over in North Korea.
Right. Well, you can't have friends. So well, that's that true. Wouldn't work. Right. Well, North Korea has no independent media. Radios and televisions are pre-tuned to government stations, and the government prohibits and jams foreign broadcasts. So no Kardashians for them. Nope.
You know, that might be one of the good things about living in North Korea.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Who knows? As of 2017, there were 14,000 internet users, less than 0.1% of the population.
We have in our internet group, we have nobody from North Korea. I always wondered when I look at our downloads, we have none from North Korea.
Shocking. Well, look at North Korea's internet usage compared to South Korea, where 73% of the population utilizes the internet.
Well, despite the public's exposure to the web, North Korea does have a website. And it's pretty startling to read, especially while digesting the facts we just mentioned. For instance, take this quote from February 11, 2019. Today, the DPRK set the line of prioritizing science and technology as the strategic one for the building of a socialist power and put it forward as an important requirement to develop cutting-edge science and technology in the earliest possible date, raising the country's science and technology to the world standard and guaranteeing the building of a socialist power by dint of science and technology. They're guaranteeing that in the next 10 years, 0.03% of the population will at least have AOL.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy. So obviously the statistics nowhere near back up the rhetoric. When we talked about the history of North Korea, we brought up two ideologies that define the country. Juche, again, meaning self-reliance, and Sangum, which means military strength. Both philosophies are publicly acknowledged and described, but a more insidious system is an undercurrent to both philosophies and drives the central dysfunction of the country and explains why it's so difficult to contend with it, and that is its reliance on the cult of personality. We hear the term cult of personality quite a bit, but what is it really? Well, the Collins English Dictionary defines it as deliberately cultivated adulation of a person, especially a political leader. Cult of personality in terms of leadership is mostly based on sociologist Max Weber's theory of charismatic authority, one of three leadership or authority styles, traditional, legal, and charismatic. Traditional authority is just that. It's based on tradition. The ability and the right to rule is passed down, often through family, and it doesn't evolve and it does not facilitate social change. A monarchy is an example of traditional authority. Legal authority is driven by a formal belief in the content of the law, whether it be legal or natural. Obedience is not given to a specific individual leader, whether they are traditional or charismatic, but instead to a set of uniform principles. The U.S. is supposed to be driven by this type of authority, and we see it in the Constitution.
That's correct. Now we are at charismatic authority, Karen. Weber
something you're very, very familiar with, right?
A little bit, yes. Yeah. Now, Weber actually seemed to like this theory best and wrote a lot on it. Now, the origin of the word charisma is ecclesiastical Latin for favor freely given or gifted with grace. And I know that you thought ecclesiastical was going to throw me, Karen.
No, because you're gifted with grace. I knew you would get through it.
Oh, good. It has religious connotations, and Weber takes those and applies them to the secular. Now, according to Yale's Modern Social Theory, audiences and followers believe that charismatic leaders have a close connection to a divine power, have exceptional skills, or are exemplary in some or multiple ways. Charismatic leaders promise change for the future and for the society, and also change people's attitudes and values. In this way, charismatic authority is revolutionary in a way that traditional and legal rational authority are not. It's this form of charismatic authority that leads to what we know as a cult of personality. North Korean leadership and the Kim family have the practice down to a science. And they had a good model since the term personality cult became popular after Khrushchev's secret speech at the 20th Party Congress in 1956, when he used it to explain how Stalin consolidated power in his personal dictatorship. The ensuing abuses of power, an extraordinary adulation of Stalin. Now remember, North Korea's roots developed in this soil. Again, you're like Walt Whitman there. You should be writing for Hallmark here soon, okay?
Well, political scientist Chang has described the personality cult as the artificial elevation of the status and authority of one man through the deliberate creation, projection, and propagation of a godlike image. This is exactly what has developed in the DPRK, as well as in our podcast.
Okay.
personal worship of Kim Il-sung came to fruition after the mass purge of the anti-Kim factions of the 1953 Korean War. The process of establishing an unchallenged one-man rule system was complete by 1958. The cult of personality had two objectives: cementing Kim Il-sung's one-man rule and opening the door to his family's ascension to power. Methods used to instill the cult of personality included fabricating symbols, creative history, and indoctrination.
Now, here are some of the methods used. First, it's use of titles such as Father Chairman, Great Chairman, and Heavenly One, all terms that have been bandied about at my residence from time to time. Now, these were all used to address Kim. His name was printed in bold type on all publications, causing it to always stand out. I'm going to have to go back to our Facebook page and see if I'm in all caps. All institutional documents, including the Constitution, they had a Constitution, labor laws, land laws, and educational texts were authored by Kim. He was a busy guy. All publications, including newspapers, magazines, and textbooks, were introduced by words of instruction from Kim. And all North Koreans were taught at school that they were clothed, fed, and nurtured in all aspects of life by the grace of the chairman. Now, off the subject, one day my boys and everybody else pushed me to the point of no return and were questioning my authority in my house, and I had to stop, stand in the living room and say, "You understand that I am the river from which all life in this house springs?" And they kind of laughed at me.
Do not question my authority.
Yeah, do not question my authority. It really didn't make a big impact on
Yeah, I would imagine not. So basically every aspect of daily life is lived through the worship of the Kim family. Usually, politics based on a cult of personality is unsustainable. The likely reason North Korea has been so successful in this regard is that the country is so small and that makes it much easier to control. The truly ironic thing here is that everything about North Korean culture is based on their philosophy of self-reliance. The idea of self denotes a spirit of individualism, but in their interpretation, the individual is not the citizen, it is the leader, and self is the collective as an extension of that leader. And also, when you were talking about the Constitution, they actually have something that's kind of akin to a Bill of Rights, but basically it's like you have the right to follow the leader. I mean, like, it's pretty humorous when you read through it and you realize that everything they're saying they have the right to do has to do with following what the Kim family says. So it's this deeply ingrained cult of personality within the leadership of North Korea that makes our president's words so concerning. Words like, "His country does love him. His people, you see the fervor. They have a great fervor." And, "He's smart. Loves his people. He loves his country." Language like this legitimizes a country ruling its people by complete indoctrination. When asked if he had a message for the North Korean people, the president said, "I think you have somebody that has great feeling for them. He wants to do right by them, and we got along really well. We had a great chemistry." And the great chemistry thing, as well as the whole "I fell in love" comment from the beginning of the show, well, this was North Korea's official news brief on that matter.
Well, what they had to say was, and this is almost embarrassing to read. It's like a love letter it's like opening up someone's journal or diary, right?
And
listening
to their official news brief on what Trump said about falling in love with them. Yeah.
U.S. President Trump lost his heart to Chairman Kim Jong-un. It is because of Kim Jong-un's manly audacity. In his course of life, Trump has not met a man such as Chairman Kim Jong-un, who had a great pluck. Maybe he built a relationship of mutual trust called Revolutionary Comrade, beyond admiration, rivalry, and a feeling of respect.
Yeah.
The U.S. has been indiscreet in employing means to strangle Pyongyang. However, Chairman Kim Jong-un remains unfazed. Far from giving a signal for surrender, he becomes stronger and hits back to the U.S. Trump is correctly appreciating Chairman Kim Jong-un's inflexible grit to reunify the Korean Peninsula and live in harmony. No leaders in the world get praised by Trump, but Chairman Kim Jong-un draws praise from him. It is right that Chairman Kim Jong-un's broad-minded pluck, unique and uncommon letter diplomacy captivated Trump. Trump, who raised his voice, fire and fury, and clamored the annihilation of North Korea, fell in love with the Supreme Leader of North Korea. It is true that his love is not fake. This particular news brief was from January 23rd this month.
Right, like so, a couple of weeks ago. Yeah.
Although tinged with the usual posturing, I think that that kind of sets the tone for these negotiations.
Right, right. There's also concrete evidence of noncompliance. For example, Bloomberg reports that recent examinations show that North Korea continued to operate two suspected uranium enrichment facilities, one near its long-established nuclear center and another location suspected of being a gas centrifuge site. In July of last year, Secretary of State Michael Pompeo acknowledged in Senate testimony that North Korea was still producing fissile material. Other reports suggest North Korea bolstered its arsenal in the run-up to the Trump summit and still runs a plant believed to have produced Kim's first ICBMs capable of reaching the U.S. homeland. They say the regime recently expanded a factory, probably making engines for new, easier-to-hide solid-fuel rockets, and enlarged an underground base for long-range missiles. Non-proliferation analysts say that Kim's strategy appears to be quietly fortifying the arsenal that he has, while creating the diplomatic climate necessary for North Korea to get sanctions lifted and be tolerated as a nuclear state. So combine the psychological leader of a cult of personality and the intelligence supporting noncompliance, and you have a setting that is likely not going to result in any substantial change. But based on past meetings, we should expect a flurry of tweets from the White House telling us that the world has been saved and the most dangerous thing in North Korea are...
Chopsticks. He's going to say chopsticks. We've disarmed them with everything. They don't even have they don't have shovels, picks, anything. Chopsticks.
Right.
We've made North Korea great again.
So. We do need to pay attention to the historic part, though. History has shown us over and over again that we shouldn't trust any promise that North Korea makes. We're going to have to wait.
North Korea is basically Lucy with the football, and we are Charlie Brown. And every time we talk to him, we think, this time we're going to kick the football.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we always end up on our back.
Right. Well, we're going to have to wait for the dust to settle from the second summit to know what's really going to happen. But we suspect it's likely a frog and scorpion scenario. Wouldn't you say so? That's kind of what we're...
I would say so, I think. Although, you know, now obviously we don't want this guy to have nuclear... We don't even want this guy to have firecrackers. I mean, he's a lunatic. Right. But does it ever strike you as odd that we... the only country that actually dropped nuclear weapons on someone are concerned that other people are going to get them? I mean, I always wonder in my head, like, why do we get to be the deciders on who gets nuclear weapons?
Okay, you know what? We went through this twice. We went through this two times, and not once did you add this.
It's a question. It's a legitimate question. It just occurred to me while I was sitting here.
No,
I'm not saying they should have them.
You think about that all the time. It did not just occur to you. You just decided to bring it up right now.
Okay, I'll cut that part out.
No, it's okay. You can leave it in. Keep going.
I just wonder when we became the arbiters of peacefully coexisting with other, because we were the first ones to get a nuclear weapon and we couldn't wait to use it.
I mean, we learned the lesson. We're like you. You know how you tell everybody like how to be because you've been there? That's basically what the U.S. is. They're like you.
But we haven't been there. We've dropped the weapons on people. And I know that we don't want these rogue states and lunatics to have nuclear weapons. But sometimes I think there is a legitimacy that they're afraid to not have them when everyone else is starting to get. It's just, it's a tough question to answer, really.
Mm-hmm.
So I raise it to you because you are so wise and sage that I thought maybe you had an answer for it.
I do not. At least not on the spur of the moment. No.
Okay. Well, then that is all I have to say about that then.
We would like to thank everybody who takes the time to listen to us. And we just appreciate every single one of you. We want to give a special shout out to all of our Patreon supporters. If you would like to support us on Patreon, you can find us Context and Clarity Podcast on Patreon, correct? Is that right?
That's correct.
All right. So we appreciate all of you. Thank you so much. Bye, everybody.
Bye.